Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. And welcome to another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. We're here at episode number 157. It is the middle to end of April right now, 2010, depending on when you're listening to this. But there is lots going on. This is a show you don't want to miss. We have a great guest that's coming up. He is a guy that makes technical analysis simple, and I've talked to him before, and I got to tell you something. If you need to clear your head of what's going on with the noise in the markets and maybe understand how to get on board or get off, whether it's the market, whether it's a stock, this is the guy to listen to. Terry Bedford is going to be with us and our guest in a moment after I discuss some of the major issues that are going on this week. And boy, there are a few things that are just, I mean, wow. Friday alone was amazing. Just absolutely amazing. Who would have thought after all this time letting Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, all the gang off without anything but a hand slap or even a wink and a nod maybe is better suited for the discussion of all the things that have happened over the last couple of years that now the SEC is doing a direct action and accusing Goldman Sachs of fraud when it comes to the CDO that they placed with actually Paulson Funds, Paulson the hedge fund manager, John Paulson, not Henry Paulson, although maybe he'll be implicated sometime soon also with all this. But there is something going on. We're going to talk about that in a second, and I want to talk also about a couple of different stocks that I want you to pay attention to that may be very interesting in the near future. A lot of people are asking, oh, is this the turn? Is this finally when everything's going to go down? You know, if you think about what happened on Friday, we had a combination of things. You had the layover, the negative initial claims that came out on Thursday back at about 485,000 claims, much higher than was anticipated, but still everybody scratching their head wondering, why are they so high still, and why is the unemployment rate staying steady? Why is it that we saw the non-farm payrolls actually move higher, but these initial claims are just not budging? This is a big question that everybody's been asking, economists and investors, and I'm sure you've been asking the same question yourself. Well, there's no real answer to this. I'm not going to, you know, kind of surprise you. Oh, I have the answer. We don't have the answer either. It's kind of this conundrum where there is just a very limited amount of hiring right now in most sectors overall. That's been good to the stock market, as strange as that sounds. We just wrote up our quarterly economic commentary and review. We do this every single quarter for our clients. And we talked about in that how actually the high unemployment is somewhat good for companies as they have less expenses and earnings are much better because of it. That's what's been driving this market. Just this week we had, I believe it was Bank of America Merrill, I think it was them, they had up their 12-month target on the S&P 500 to 1350. Now, if you remember, 6 months ago, maybe even 4 months ago, most were saying that about 1250 was the top end for the S&P 500 in 2010, and already we're kind of close to that number. You know, we're getting very close already, and the year is not even nearly over. So whether or not the fact is that the market has overheated or they underestimated the power of the earnings, the net earnings. Now, again, it could be on lower revenue. It could be on lower sales. Don't mistake that. Don't mistake the fact that it is possible to have higher earnings and better earnings, even though you have lower sales. And that's just a simple process of re-engineering your business and cutting down on expenses. Think about it for a second, right? So if you have $100,000 of income and you have, let's say, $100,000 of expenses, well, it's very simple, right? You're making nothing. You're not saving any money. But if you actually can cut down your expenses to, let's say, $25,000 somehow, and you only make $50,000 of gross somehow, you still got now a better net number to yourself. So it's not just a matter of, you know, looking at how a company's earnings are lower. Look at them in the respect to, you know, what are the revenues and the net earnings, and what does that say for the growth of the company on an earnings standpoint? That's the profit of the company. Profitability of a company is what we're investing in. Simple, right? Makes sense? So now when we look at this whole situation, we also saw that one of the things that was problematic, you know, because there was some great news, by the way. We had some great inventory data. We had some great factory numbers. We had the Philly Fed and the Empire State Fed come out. They were looking much, much stronger. But we saw the University of Michigan confidence number get, you know, bashed pretty badly. It was down. It was supposed to be at about 75 expectations. I think it was about 69. It was down from the month before. That's never a good thing when you see that, because it means that people are concerned about something, and it is a bit of a leading indicator. A leading indicator saying that, you know, maybe they're going to slow down on their spending. Maybe they're going to cut back a little bit. Maybe they're worried about the future. Maybe they're worried about their job. Maybe they're worried about something. Something is not right. Something's concerning them, and that is usually not taken well by investors. But clearly, that would have been overlooked too, in my opinion, because really right now we're in a market, we're in an environment, we've seen this before, that the good news is great news, the bad news is ignored. You've had that, remember that? That was back in, we talked about this on this podcast back in 2007, 2006 and 2007, primarily 2007, part of 2008. That was really the going theme of what was going on. We were looking at things going, wait, what's going on here? There's too much optimism out there. A lot of things that are broken underneath. Now, that's not the case as much anymore, because we are seeing a lot more things that are looking a lot better on the economies around the world. We saw Singapore increase the currency because they're trying to slow down their economy with about a 9% GDP print on that month and a 35% overall annualized, which is pretty amazing if you think about it. You saw that South Korea's their unemployment rate dipped down to 3.7%. You saw that in China, their GDP is exploding. They've actually put some clamps down on the speculation on housing, because their housing market is just going. I think it's 11% gain on housing values in 1 month. Right? I mean, that's just astounding. And what's happening is they put some speculation clamps down, so that you have to put 50% down on a second home now, if you want to buy your second home. So that's good. Lots of good things happening around the world. Australia looks, you know, pretty good. Europe is a disaster. Let's just get that straight. Europe is a disaster. I find the prime minister of Greece to be an absolute outright liar. And he is, you know, someone not to be trusted. His comments are constantly not only pompous when he is tormenting and taunting the currency traders and those that don't believe in his situation, but on top of it, what comes out of his mouth can't be trusted. And the same thing holds true pretty much with the entire European situation when it comes to Greece, because really all they're trying to do is, in any way and shape and form, and you have to respect this, I guess, is trying to save their hide, trying to save the euro from a devastating situation if they have to, you know, come in and not only bail out Greece, but Portugal and Spain, and who knows who's behind that. You know, Europe is really a powder keg right now, and if they don't get the situation fixed in Greece, even though it is a very small part of the overall global and the European economy, it's just a bad situation because they are attached to the euro. And they're desperately trying to bolster confidence in the investors out there, so they pay off the debt for them and move on, and, you know, saying they're going to back them. But you know what? At the same time, breaking the rules of the Maastricht Treaty, we talked about this at length on DH Unplugged this week. But so we have that as the backdrop of what's going on. And then we have the strange other thing that's going on. Did you see this story that the ash cloud that's coming from the volcano in Iceland, it's delaying and it's screwing up air travel so badly that they have calculated that it costs $200 million a day in lost fees and lost revenue, tickets, for the airline industry overall. $200 million a day, this cloud. Now, the problem is not only this cloud. It's like, what's behind this cloud? Is there another? There's supposedly another volcano out there that could erupt, and this one could be spewing some more things in the air. And the problem is that this ash seems to clog the engines and make them stall. And I don't know about you, that is not what I want to happen when I'm in the air, is to have my Jet Airlines engines stall. Not a fun situation. And this is a real problem. As a matter of fact, Poland has actually made some gestures. They're saying that they're not going to have the funerals for the president and the entire cabinet, if you will, until President Obama can come over there. I think I was pretty impressed with that. I mean, they hold President Obama in such high regard, they're going to actually hold the funeral to a point and postpone it till actually he can get there, because we can't fly the planes over that area right now. Kind of interesting. But let's pick up on this Goldman Sachs situation. Let's talk about this Goldman Sachs debacle. And by the way, I listened to the SEC conference call. They had a conference call on Friday at about, I think it was 11 o'clock. And I listened to it intently. I wanted to find out what was going on and, you know, listen to some of the questions and answers. Basically, what they were saying was that there was this CDO, this instrument that was created by Goldman for the use of protection, insurance, if you will, against really the subprime meltdown. And there was a lot of different hands involved in this, and they're obviously pointing out one person to take the barb on it and kind of have to do the harry-carry within Goldman. And, you know, what they're saying is that Paulson & Company, like I said before, the hedge fund was involved with this. There's a lot of different names in this, but basically there's potentially $1 billion made on this transaction, and it was a fraudulent transaction because it wasn't disclosed in all the different filings that were made, and it's a mess. It's an absolute mess. The bottom line is what my takeaway from it, and my concern with that conversation, that particular teleconference, was when a question was asked about, you know, is this the extent of where you're going to be going and looking for people that were involved in this? The answer was something to the effect of, this is just one of the areas we're looking into. In other words, leaving the door open that other companies may have had similar circumstances that were writing these kind of CDO instruments, these collateralized debt instruments, and these kind of options, if you will, instruments that would be highly, highly leveraged in order to benefit from the downfall and default of either a company or of mortgage pools. Now, in response to this, first of all, let me give you the breakdown. I put this on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, the show notes. Let me find this. I did a printout of the actual major players in this area and how they fared for the day. Now, remember something. Bank of America came out this week on Friday, right before all this happened, and announced a really good number, at least from the aspect of an earnings beat. And while GE didn't do so well on the top line, they blew out the bottom line. Both of those and very questionable balance sheet numbers, and we all know the hocus pocus that is played with these numbers when it comes to the banks right now, because let's face it, they don't have a lot of expenses that are going along with this, because they're able to hide a lot, and the tax laws have really made things look a lot different than they are. But let me just kind of read down a few of these names and what happened. Now, Bank of America was up about 3% pre-market when they announced the number this morning. They ended up the day on Friday after all this down 5.5%. Citigroup was down 5.5%. Goldman Sachs down 12.79%. Deutsche Bank down 9% and change. They're another one that's probably going to be looked into in all this. GE was down 2.75%. And the rest of the list is on the website if you want to see what happened there. But boy, what a disaster. Not only that, it spread across the entire stock market in the U.S. and around the world. And you have to wonder, just for a moment, thinking about this objectively, is this something that is a one-off on the investment banks, or is this something much bigger? Is there something that we are seeing that is a turn in investor sentiment, or is it one of those situations that it's kind of like, okay, a couple of days of questions, and then earnings will take over again, real earnings, not the bogus bank earnings, but real earnings. When we see an IBM number come out, when we see an Intel number come out, when we see the area of the rest of the world, ex financial problems and financial engineering, frankly, is this going to be a one-off? I mean, I don't know what would really be such a negative sentiment right now when it came to the markets, because all of the economic numbers are looking very nice. There's no really rolling happening. A little consumer confidence issue. We have some unemployment question. But generally speaking, we're at a really sweet spot right now when it comes to the markets. Now, the other question is, have the markets, have stocks run up too much in the face of this? You know, so a big run up through for many stocks through, in March, let's say halfway through March, the second half of March, and then, you know, kind of level off a little bit. Then all of a sudden the financials went out of control before earnings, and all of a sudden things are slowing down a little bit. But, you know, you see a company like, UPS and say that they're really raising their guidance, and you see, FedEx follow through, and you see, the economic indicators that look sharp and look good, ex some of the materials companies. Alcoa, you know, stunk it up pretty well. They're really just awful, awful quarter, and prospects that don't look so great either, I must tell you. But nonetheless, I do wonder, and we do not think right now, until of course, we break down through some significant technical support levels, that this is anything that may last for too long. I think it will put a little bit of a mar on the investment bankers, but for right now, just for the moment, that's about it. And yes, some of the stocks, like a Google that was down 7.5%, missed its number. But then again, it ran up about 7% over the last 2 weeks. So, you have to question whether or not this is actually, something that you want to consider to be a one-off or not. Now, before we get to our guests, I want to mention a couple of things to you, and we're going to also talk about some stocks that I want you to take a look at. One of them we put on the website, and I actually put, I'll get to that in a second. I'll tell you what I put on there. If you're kind of wondering, well, is it a time to invest? Is it not a time to invest? I'm not sure if I want to be in. I'm not sure if I want to be out. I want to see if I can capture both sides if possible. I want to be hedged. You know what? We manage money. If you're interested, because I get emails all the time, and I want to make sure every time that I see when the emails spike that people couldn't find the information, I tell you. I got a call just the other day. Somebody said, where is the information? And actually, I overheard somebody in my office taking this call. And where is the information on the website about your managed growth strategy? If you go to the website, first of all, you go to the show notes, there's a big box that says, hey, here's how you invest. Here's how you look into it. You can see a 14-minute virtual tour there. On the main page, the main side of thedisciplinedinvestor.com, to the right, there's a picture of me. You'll see with my book, The Disciplined Investor. And just to the right, there's this kind of blue icon or a blue graphic that says The Disciplined Investor Growth Strategy, hedge fund without all the hedge fund and all that. It's not a hedge fund. So, take a look at that. If you've ever been interested, I think there's some great opportunity. We are seeing some wonderful opportunity, both sides, short and long. And I think that it may be time for you to consider, maybe now's the time to start investing. Check it out. We'll be there. You'll like it because we have full transparency, and you can check out all of what we do on our private website and our blog. And we do update that quite often, as a matter of fact. That's updated daily, and a weekly composite comes out for you, so everybody knows exactly what's going on. Full transparency over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Okay, now, let me talk about three stocks. I'm going to talk about one major speculative play. I'm going to get dirty. I'm going to do the things that, are kind of like, why is he doing that? But I'm going to tell you why. And I'm going to also share with you that we own this for our clients, a small amount, very small amount. It may be all over the place. It may get a little wacky. But the reason we're bringing this up is because this is one of those that could catch the eye of, let's say, one of the things we like to look at is IBD, the newspaper, Investors Business Daily. They have the IBD 100 that is, one of the supposedly the 100 best growing opportunities that they see using their criteria. Now, one of the things they look for is a lot of growth and consistent earnings and kind of new flavor. Well, we looked at briefing.com. The traders over there have identified a stock, and that stock is potentially going to be in, maybe. Not definitely, in the IBD if it meets a couple of criteria. Supposedly, this stock holds a lot of opportunity because it has growth as it has, and the sales are just growing. It's a company in a sweet spot. It's engaged in the coal production and consolidation and cleaning and wholesaling in China, which is obviously pretty hot, and that's not going to slow down for a while. But basically, the name of the stock is LNL Energy, symbol LLEN. I put on the website, I thought I would go right along with the IBD chart, and I laid out some of the basic components of why this is an exciting stock, just for you to kind of look at from a research standpoint. Don't invest in it unless you really are aggressive, please. Be very careful. It has an up-down volatility. Now, you have to go to the site and look at this chart because you'll follow along with me. It has an up-down volume ratio of 1.9, very strong volume in. In other words, they're buying going on. No debt. An EPS growth rate of 81%, huge. PE ratio of only 15. Management owns 40%. Not any funds that are identified own this yet. When funds do recognize this stock as an up-and-comer and possible player out there, this could really vault the stock dramatically. If you just look at the EPS, I'm not even going to read it because the numbers are ridiculous. I mean, the EPS growth is off the hook. Sales is off the hook. Small company, only about $342 million company market cap, about 14 million shares in float. This is one of those companies that if it hits 15, there's a good chance it has a lot of the characteristics that like an IBD would like. Now, if IBD likes it, boy, they put it in their IBD 100, and especially for the new issues, it's pretty much chomped up and bought rather strongly. Now, that may not happen. The theory is if it gets close to 15, and it's in the, I don't know, you know, mid-12s, it's 13, depending on when you're listening to this, you know, this is an interesting opportunity. Be very careful. You know, this is not something for the faint of heart at all. But I do want to talk to you about, and that's, again, LLEN. Check it out on the website. Look at it carefully before you do anything with it. There's something I thought I'd throw at you. There's something else I want to throw at you. I want to throw out a thesis that we've been working on for some time now, and we talked about it on DH Unplugged this week, and it's very simple. We all know that states have a significant problem when it comes to their revenues, their earnings, their tax receipts. You know, they have a gigantic budget gap. What can they do? Well, they really can't tax people more because that's pretty much getting to the end of the rope there. They can't rely on property taxes because we know what's going on in that circumstance. And, you know, generally they just are not fond of cutting expenses. So what do they do? Well, they have a few options out there. One of the things we think is a really interesting option is for the early adopters especially, is for states to look into the idea of gaming. Gaming will be something that we think is going to be, you know, very well received, or at least very well, you know, something that's going to be brought up to the various states in a very quick manner. Now, let me explain a little bit more what I mean. Let me get the list real quick. We have a list. What do we have? Massachusetts recently passed through their Congress gaming for the state. Florida is looking to expand. We have Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, Kansas, and this is a partial list of what's going on. They realize that gaming, whether it's either lottery or slot machines, parimutuels, table games, or something, you know, some combination of all the above, is going to allow for them to at least meet part of their budget gap. Maybe not all of it, but they need something. They need something. Now, morally and ethically, they've been very much against this for a long time. And of course, we got New Jersey and we got Vegas and, you know, down in Mississippi and a few other places. But, you know, generally speaking, that most states have been really kind of like saying no to this. Now, of course, there's easy ways and hard ways to deal with this. But one of the things I think is really interesting, if this is occurring, where can we benefit? There's a few companies out there, two of them that we identified. One is directly, one is kind of indirectly. WMS Industries. This is a company that basically makes, let's just say, slot machines. Now, they've already identified in a report that we just read this week that if the casino gaming goes through in Massachusetts, there'll be a 14-cent pop per share of additional EPS for WMS utilizing the current I think J.P. Morgan put this out, their current thesis, if all the companies that are going to be involved are going to split it. And, of course, you have like IGT, you have you know, Bally's, you have a variety of other companies that also do slots. And if you split it up and you do what the usual, you know, what usually goes on, you know, you get about a third, they'll get about 30% of the overall, talking about 9,000 machines that are going in there. You have casino refreshes going on around the country and around the world. So the slot machine business, in our opinion, is very, very strong and very much of great opportunity. Now, again, this is the thesis is here that many states are going to be potentially adding gaming. Does it make sense that that will happen? I think it makes sense. I think that when you look at not only intellectually and kind of from a theory standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. Now, will they allow it? I don't know. You know, if they don't allow it, maybe they'll allow the Indian reservations to handle it and they'll take a piece of it. Either way, there's still an opportunity for slot machines. The other thing that I think is interesting is that they're going to start to add table games at a lot of these places. One of the things that happens with table gaming like blackjack is that there's inherent problems to the house, right? So you have the problem of the dealer is maybe not fast enough, not efficient enough. Maybe the dealer cheats. Maybe the dealer gets sick. It's an employee, right? Okay. Well, Shuffle Master makes a lot of different devices. One of the things they make, you've probably seen it, is they have automatic shufflers that will shuffle either a continuous shuffle on a shoe on a seven deck, or they may shuffle, let's say, partial shoes for just use of a regular dealer. They also have a variety of other gaming tables and games, like, for example, three-card poker, where they get royalties on the play. And that's their game. They own it. I think they also own Let It Ride and a few others. One of the things that really attracted us to Shuffle Master, and again, we'll put a little chart on the website there that to take a look at, is that they have a new game out. And the game is, well, it's not a new game, but it's a new style of play. Here's really what's cool. I think it's really cool. And I think this is what may be adopted by not only some casinos, but states as well. You know, because they're trying to save some money. You know, if you go by what I said, that the problem you have is not only breaks and sicknesses and cheating and inefficiencies, et cetera, with the dealer. Well, Shuffle Master now makes a virtual dealer. It's like a big screen TV, and it could change the person that's actually dealing. But they actually talk to you and take you through the card process. You play blackjack. And in front of you have like a virtual hand, if you will. But it's like a regular table. You sit there and you converse with other people around you, which is part of the fun of playing cards. And what happens there is that, you know, when you look at the game itself, you don't have the problems with dealers getting sick, inefficiencies, cheating, and all that. In addition, because it is computer-based, you could actually change the game on some of these machines. So let's say that you were, you're heavy on blackjack tables around the casino, and somebody, you know, a lot of people want to play Let It Ride or something else, whatever it is. You can actually turn some of these machines into another style. You could change the actual virtual dealer. Maybe you want to make it a guy with brown hair. Maybe it's a woman with blonde hair. I don't know, whatever the reasons are. But the good news is that this is something that's really a new technology, and we think that it could really take off. This is a volatile stock. It's thinly traded on the Shuffle Master these days. It used to be a lot bigger stock until kind of things just fell apart in terms of the casino industry. But right now, if we're seeing that, we're finding that some of the casinos are seeing a little bit of an uptick. There could be a refresh coming in, and because of all the money that they took in, they're trying to, you know, win in Las Vegas and Boyd, and all these companies are trying to do what they can to turn it around a bit and to entice people to come in. Well, obviously, one of the big things is to have the freshest of fresh, the most efficient, and the most, highest earning slot machines. So WMS Industries and also Shuffle Master are two stocks that you can take a look at. WMS is more of a fundamentally sound company, something that we like from a lot of different angles. Shuffle Master is more of a new idea, theory-based investment. And it's the same thing as LLEN. You know, you look at those sometimes in your portfolio, you want to have a little bit more of the speculative side of things, you know, in the portfolio, along with, you know, your core positions that you've used your fundamentals and your technicals on to try to give you that level of basis and understanding of what you have, what the outlook is, the stability of the company. And sometimes you want to kind of have a little bit more spice in the portfolio, just to add a little bit of something, a few percent here or there. That's what we're talking about with a couple of these. So that pretty much will give you a kind of a view of what happened last week. You know, where are we going next week? I still think that when you look at, you know, the general trend right now, just for the moment, it's still up. Earnings are looking really sharp. And I think this could be a somewhat of a one-off, but it does put up a major alarm bell right now in terms of, you know, the markets, that they can sell off this violently with a news item. So keep that in mind. And when we get back, we're going to bring on Terry Bedford. I would stay where you are and really, you know, listen closely, because this guy, I think, is going to give you some things that are really interesting. And he's always educated me in a great way. So stick around. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're back, and as I told you before, we have a very special guest today, because he comes highly recommended from a very dear friend of mine, John Markman. And John said, you got to talk to Terry Bedford, who's the president and founder of Bedford & Associates. It's a research group, kind of a boutique investment research firm located in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Terry, we're not going to hold that against you, buddy.
That's good.
How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
How are you?
Good. So let's talk a little bit about what you do. I know you do a lot of technical analysis. I know you do a lot of option work, and that's your passion. Give me just a quick backdrop of kind of why you do what you do versus, let's say, a fundamental approach versus maybe only stocks. I mean, give me kind of why you are, you know, you think that this is the best approach for you at this point and why you love it so much.
The reason that I've really been interested in the technical side of the market is I tend to find that what happens is you tend to develop opinions that are hard to unseat. So if you become bullish or bearish, and then you really can't shake that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I found that the fundamental guys, they fall into what is better known as a value trap. So they get into a stock, they like it, they like the story, and they'll be stuck in that stock forever, even though the stock price is dropping, because they believe deep down that the stock has to go up because of some metric, this or that. What technical guys do and what I try to do is I try and just follow the trend. The market's going up, and I want to be long. If the market's going down, I want to be short. It's tougher to be short than long, but I want to be on both sides of the market, and I want to be objective. And I find if you take the technical side and you don't fall into sort of the indicator trap, which a lot of technicians do fall into, so they're becoming more crystal ball sort of guys. If you don't take that tack, then you become objective, and you can really get in the market when the market's going up and get out of the market when it's going sideways and get short the market when it's going down.
So just back up. You said something about indicators. Now, give me an example. Yeah. Of what you're talking about stochastics, MACDs, you're talking about RSIs, all those indicators that you kind of stay away from, or is that, you know, that you don't live by?
I won't say I stay away from them, but what I do is I don't let them override the tape. For instance, a lot of technical traders, a lot of technicians, they've been bearish all the way up because the volume has been declining.
Right.
Volume is sort of the lifeblood of the stock market. You've got to have volume because that means people have conviction and they are buying. But in reality, you don't make money from volume. You make money from price. You've got to keep that in the back. You've got to understand that. People have to understand that they've got to follow price. If the price is going up, you have to be long. You can't be short. You can't say, well, it's going to go down because there's no volume. You've got to be long. If it does go down, then you can be short or be out. But in the interim, if the price is going up, you have to be long. So volume has been a very poor indicator the whole way since the March lows.
And as a matter of fact, a lot of technical analysts that are worth a lot of salt, by the way, are very much in a quandary right now because they're finding it to be a very weird circumstance. They're making a lot of excuses, and I understand why, because I also have the same concern. The biggest concern I have, and maybe tell me where I'm wrong about this. First of all, yes, I agree. Price moving up, long, make money, have a nice day, move on, go home, have dinner. Okay, but the fact of the matter is, the spooky thing is when you step back for a second, and maybe this is where the mistake is. A lot of people say when you step back, when you look at the volume of the markets on the up days has been pathetic, or at least below average, and at the same time on the down days has been dramatic. Mm-hmm. So. Again, you're saying that's all great, and that may have its time to look at, but with the market in a general trend up or down, play the trend, look at the volume and understand what's going on, but yet at the same time, don't get trapped by it. Is that the summation?
That's it. That's basically it. You can't fall into a sort of an indicator paralysis where you say, okay, there's no volume. That's why I'm going to let me get it back up. A lot of guys will be bullish. They'll see a chart breakout. They'll say, okay, I've got to buy that. They'll see no volume and say, okay, I'm not buying that because there's no volume. Well, they can always find reasons not to buy it. Now, don't get me wrong. Volume is important. Volume is the lifeblood of stock markets. But if you have been watching volume and not investing in stocks, and you missed the entire rally from the March lows, and there's no excuse for that other than, you know, you're just paralyzed by the fact that you're looking for a reason not to be long. And a lot of people are looking for reasons not to be long. They don't trust it. And, you know, don't get me wrong. I know, even though I'm a technical guy, I know that a lot of the things that are happening are completely bogus. I know that the banks aren't making any money. They're not declaring their losses. So if you don't declare losses and you declare all your profits, then you're making a lot of money.
As I say, it's kind of like, hey, honey, I'm making $100,000 a year. And they say, well, is that your net? Well, yeah, I'm not including any of my expenses, of course, but I make $100,000 a year. It's like, well, if you add your expenses, you're losing 50 grand a year, buddy. So let me ask you. So let's go to that, because that's a great thing to discuss, Terry. I mean, here's the deal.
Yeah.
So you look at I don't care what bank it is. It doesn't matter the bank. But let's just say the banks.
Right.
And you know in your heart of hearts and whether you're right or wrong, but you believe the banks mm-hmm. are bogus. Maybe some are more bogus than others, but they're bogus. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you say, mm-hmm. I can't bring myself to invest in this because I don't understand the fundamentals, or I believe this or believe that. Yet at the same time, you're saying that who cares? The price is moving up. I'm buying. Am I off on this? Is that too simplistic?
No, that's it. That's it exactly. I think what you have to realize, and I don't want to sound preachy or anything, but what you have to realize is that all of the stuff in the stock market, every metric you can possibly ascertain is one. It could be construed one way or another. Nobody really knows which is going to be the prevalent interpretation. But what we do know is there's one indicator that tells all, and that's price. If the price is going up, then you have to be long. If the price is going sideways, you can be out. If the price is going down, you should be short.
All right,
that's the reality.
So now let's teach me and everybody listening how you identify. I know this sounds silly, but how do you identify if a price is going up and or down, for that matter, and when it is actually reversing? You follow my question? I know it's simplistic. I understand that, but seriously.
Yep.
Give us that answer.
In a nutshell, you're going to look at a series of moving averages. You can look at them on all time frames, but all the same moving averages. They are the 200 exponential, 100 exponential, 50, and 20 exponential. Look at all those moving averages, any time frame you want. If a stock goes up and then falls back to those moving averages, one of those moving averages, then rallies again, the stock is going up. And we have had a series of what I'd even call mini corrections, where the market goes down, everybody says, okay, the world's coming to an end, here it is, we're going back to reality. People now realize the banks really aren't making any money, they're just not declaring their losses, or they're marking their assets to make believe. Every time that happens, the market goes down to, let's say it is the 200-day moving average or the 50-day moving average, and then you find this tremendous bid, and the market goes right back up and makes a new high, a relative new high. Now, there might be less volume or not as much volume as people would like to see, but the reality is when the price goes down to a moving average, a rising moving average, there are buyers. The buyers push the stock or the index back up to new highs, and that's what's been happening since March. That's the trend. The trend is up.
Right,
you can't fight that.
Right, so what happens now because, by the way, that will happen for so long, whether it's a stock or market, and it's going to turn. I mean, nothing goes up forever, nothing goes down forever, right?
Exactly.
So when do we then, because usually what will happen is also, let's say, that exact situation will happen where you touch a 50-day moving average, and maybe go under slightly, and then it just rallies right back above, and then it moves up again, then it tests again. And usually three times or so is a probable test factor for, if it's going to come down, because if it comes down that third or fourth time, the exhaustion comes in, it just moves over. Is that so far so good?
That's correct. That's exactly right.
Okay, so now...
That's exactly what happened.
And by the way, by that time, you probably got a flattening 50-day, because it's moving up. Now it's in a consolidation phase, right? And at that point, when it does move over, it's starting to roll down the 50-day. Again, theoretically, in this scenario. So now what happens is that you can't be sure about this, because a lot of things can happen, but now you change your trend direction. Is that a correct statement?
That's correct.
Okay, so now you may go short. You may dip your toes in till kind of, a little bit, and then add a little bit like you would anything else. You don't maybe go all in or all out. You kind of like move forward with it. So when you look at that scenario and, you look at a situation where, you have a particular stock or a particular market, let's say, that's very simple. I mean, it's a very simple way to go. There's, a lot of people spend a lot of time on, turning points. So let's say, for example, in the circumstance we just talked about, let's take a consolidation phase that's over time. And now all of a sudden, the stock breaks and comes down. Whether or not you're short or long, whatever happens, now it's down, and it's much below its 50-day moving average, okay? It's much below its 20-day, et cetera. So now that's all the moving averages are above, and the price of the stock in the market is below. We would consider that a downtrend, trending down situation, right?
That's right.
Okay, when is appropriate then to possibly go back in, if there is such a thing? Give me the signal, the next signal that you would use.
The signal is, And this is where volume comes into play. But the signal would be the stock crosses back through the 50 or 200-day moving averages on volume. And you know what you really want to think of it in terms is bulls and bears are two separate entities, and they're fighting. They're battling back
right,
and forth.
Right.
You know, obviously, bears want the market to go down. Bulls want to go up. And they pick lines in the sand. Those lines in the sand are generally the moving averages. And they'll fight at those lines. So they'll push the stock or the index back to a moving average. There'll be trading punches there for a few days. And as you say, there'll typically be two or three tests at that level. And on the third test, one side's going to win. And what I try and tell people is what you want to do is you want to be in the market in a situation where both bulls and bears believe exactly the same thing, because that's when you make money in the market. And they believe the same thing when one level is conceded. So let's say it's the 50-day moving average. In your scenario, the stock is below the index, or excuse me, the stock is below the 50-day moving average.
Mm-hmm.
It battles for a few days, pops up through the 50-day moving average. Now, in theory, what's happened is the people who are bearish, they have now conceded that they've lost, and they want to buy. They're bearish, they're short, they have to cover. They're buyers. The people who are bullish, they have a breakout, they want to buy. They buy. Now you have both bulls and bears doing exactly the same thing. They're both buying, and that's when you want to be long. And that's the ideal situation, because it's very difficult to lose money when both entities, bulls and bears, are doing the same thing.
So now when you are looking at a 50-day moving average, is it a requirement to be long, to be either flat or up? What happens if you move above the 50-day moving average and you stay above the 50-day moving average in a downtrending 50-day moving average?
If we stay above the... Well, those are tougher environments. I mean, I'll use a lot of things. I'll use trend lines and... I don't want to make it too simple, because there's a lot of things
right.
I'll do.
Fibonacci's
and all kinds of other things. But basically, I'm using price and trend lines. So if a stock is in a trend line, it's trending up, and it's above its moving averages, I want to buy on pullbacks to the moving average with my stop slightly below that moving average. If a stock is below the moving average and trending lower, I want to be short the stock with my stop just above the moving average, that sort of thing.
Now, are you using closing numbers for this? I mean, this is an important question, because we've seen a lot of stocks, for example, you know, come down through their, again, I'm making this up, but a stock comes down through its 50-day average, maybe even sharply throughout the day, right? And then all of a sudden it pops back up, or it stays below. Yep. I mean, are you using a closing number? Are you using that, you know, if you look at the chart and you say, oh, look at that horrible bar. You know, is that something you look at, what the bar looks like, or is it just, okay, over the 50? Again, this is simplistic. We're just talking about moving averages. But is it the closing number you're looking for?
It's a close. I'm looking at closes. I mean, there are people that do all kinds of strange things. I don't want to diminish, you know, a candlestick and all that sort of thing. There's a lot of people believe that sort of stuff. And I think the one point I do want to leave you with, but the one point I do want to stress is that technical analysis, a lot of people, it gets a bad rap, because a lot of people think it's sort of, you got a crystal ball. You're able to predict where the market's going to go. That's not what it is at all. If you're really a good technician, what you want to be doing is you want to be following the trend. Let the tape tell you what it's doing. If it's going up, it's going up. Be long. If it's going down, be short. But what's really important to note about technical analysis is it's self-fulfilling. There are so many people that are looking at the same thing, and they all believe the same thing. And this goes back to my point about both bulls and bears being on the same side of a particular trade because the moving average has been broken. If everybody believes that, it happens.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter what reality is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing as we can talk about, you know, the banks, and we both know that the banks are not reporting real numbers. But it doesn't matter if they're not reporting real numbers. If everybody believes the stock prices are going up based on what bogus number they can report next quarter, then the stock is going up.
Yeah.
And
so
you can get yourself stuck in the... Go ahead.
You get stuck in that. But so here's a question, or here's something that I think I've taken from what you just said. It would seem to me that you mentioned, you know, a lot of people, you know, think it's hocus pocus and drawing pictures and charts and all that. But really what you're saying is, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're saying is it gives you the position to be in at that moment. In other words,
yep.
You don't have to guess about what's happening 2 weeks from now, a month from now, a year from now. You don't have to look backwards of what happened and where you've been. The question is, where is it now and what's the right position to be in up until what point? From right now. I mean, you could kind of look at it and say, right now I would be long, short, neutral of that position. Very simply. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you're out, if you're in, you know, if for example, for whatever reason you own a stock and you've had it forever and ever, and you're finally saying, all right, let me see what to do at this point with it. You can look at a chart under your circumstance and see where you should be right exactly now, and then renew that discussion tomorrow.
Yep, that's
so,
right.
So therefore, there's no guessing what's happening in 4 months. And in fact, technical analysis, in a way, the purest sense of what you're saying here is that it's not a predictor. It's a where you are now commitment.
That's right.
Okay, so I got it. Yeah.
Technical analysis, you know, good technicians should be trend followers. They shouldn't be guys that are saying on March 18th, I predict the market's going to be this. There's no way to do that.
Right.
I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. There probably is a way to do that if you can get enough people that control large volumes of money to believe that, and you can make it self-fulfilling. But in reality, the guys that do that and they say, my cycle work says the market's going to make a bottom on this day and it's going to make a top on this day, unless there are lots of people who believe that the market is going to do that, then, you know, you're just throwing darts at a board.
I got to tell you something.
It's not going to happen.
Tom McClellan is pretty good at that.
Yeah, I know. And and you know what? I'll give him credit, but a lot of his stuff and the GAN stuff, the reason that they're pretty good at it is because a lot of guys that are controlling the decisions in hedge funds, the biggest hedge funds, also believe that. So if they all believe the same thing, it's true.
Yeah, I mean, his stuff you know, comes up under the spooky category to me. You know, I've talked with him recently, well, I'm like, wow, how did he get it within a day or two?
I know of his work through John Markman, mm-hmm. our mutual friend, and when I see his dates, Tom McClellan's dates, they're exactly the same dates as all the other guys that are doing that sort of thing. So, you know, it's not. It's more that there are people, a bunch of people are following the same thing, and they are people who are influential.
Right.
I'm not saying it's Tom McClellan per se. It may be, but there's guys like Tom DeMark, and if they're telling Steve Cohen at SAC Capital, this on this date you should be buying this, and then he's buying. Well, the market goes up. He can move the market.
Yeah, I looked at some of the stuff. That DeMark stuff is also from the spooky category. I mean, we've studied and I've read books on it, and actually I've talked to Tom about it, and I got to tell you something. It's like, wait a minute, let me get this straight. We're in a 9-13-9, and it's going to roll in 2 days, and then you're like, okay. And then you're like, it did. But then again, markets roll up and down all the time. So you got to wonder what's
well,
what.
It also helps to be able to talk to Steve Cohen at SAC Capital and say, you know, my stuff says it's going to roll over this day, and then suddenly Steve Cohen is selling.
Right, so, it helps.
You know, I think one thing I do know is people would be amazed at how few people can actually control the direction of the market on a short-term basis. And there's big hedge funds. There's a lot of groupthink. They all think the same things at the same time.
Well, isn't that what happened in March, last March?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, one of the things that I was wondering is why was it so deep? As a matter of fact, I was having, bring him up again, I was talking to John Markman. I said, John, what is going on? I mean, it's like people are running from the hills, but then again, you know, it's not like I know a lot of retail and a lot of individuals. Why is this going down so fast? Just the velocity. And he said, you know what? This was a little bit after it. You know, it looks like the hedge funds are just bailing. They're just selling everything.
Indiscriminately.
Yeah, indiscriminately. They need to raise capital. They're freaking out that they're not going to get any more loans. The Lehman thing is dead. Their money is stuck for the most part. And maybe it was a little bit... maybe it was a little bit selfish of them personally. They didn't want their money stuck and not charge fees and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So you know, and they weren't going to get credit, and they would live off the potential of getting credit so that they can run their funds on leverage, et cetera. And that, not to mention that they were leveraged and they had things that were going down. And it was this constant cycle over a period of, I don't know, you know, 3-4 months that was just gosh awful. And he said, if you take out that point of, let's say, February through April, take that out, you know, take out the up and take the down out right there and kind of connect the dots to more of a consolidation, it looks a lot different. It looks a lot like a, I don't want to say a normal correction, but at least a reasonable correction, not an all-out crash. And if you can live with that, from that standpoint of looking at it like that, things look a little bit better long-term. in terms of, you know, right, where you are and where you could possibly go to.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, kind of moving forward from here. You know, right now, as you mentioned, each time the market takes a little bit of a dip, and then from a technical standpoint, obviously, it either hits a number. I mean, we knew that 1150 was a big number, but it bounced not only hard, it bounced ridiculously hard up, right? I mean, it was like, it was not even, not normal bouncing. It was ridiculous bouncing, you know, on a dime too, right? What's happening there? Yeah. Is it just that there is this underlying hand of people that are like, okay, I want this market to come back a little bit. When it does, I'm buying in. Or is it something else at work here? Because it's not, it doesn't seem like a lot of these hedge funds and mutual funds have a lot of cash left.
Well, it's the hot money. It's the hedge funds. It's tough to say that hedge funds don't have a lot of cash, because they can always get cash. They can leverage, or they can make synthetics. They can do all sorts of things to get themselves invested in the market, in and out of the market. So it's tough to say they don't have cash. But I think, again, it goes back to they're sort of being lines in the sand. You're right, 1150 is a line in the sand. If we broke 1150 on a close, the hedge funds that are bullish, a lot of hedge funds that are bullish, would become bearish. And that's where I think it's important that people realize you can talk about whatever fundamental stat you want, but if you get those guys to turn bearish, they can move the market. If they all start selling at the same time, the market goes down. There's just no ifs, ands, or about it. It goes down. And 1150 is a line in the sand. Going forward, 1228 on the S&P, we're basically 15 or 18 points away from that right now. That's another line in the sand. That's resistance. That level has been conceded. It's probably conceded by the people who are bearish. They might still be bearish and think all the same things. They think about banks and debt and the U.S. dollar and all those sorts of things. But they're going to say, you know what, the market's probably going to go up to 1228, which would be a 61.8% retracement of the entire decline from the from the October 2007 highs to the March lows. So they're saying, if we concede that decline and we sort of mass the troops and we all get bearish there again and we all start shorting the market up there, you know, that's probably a pretty safe place for us to sell. And what happened is, when we went through 1150, basically that line in the sand at 1228 was conceded. So that's where you're getting this vicious and very quick move higher, because both bulls and bears now believe the same thing. They all believe the market's going to 1228.
Which is a stone throw. But the point is, what happens there? You think? I mean, you don't think that the bears are tired at this point? I mean, they seem to be, again, when we say bears and bulls, it's this concept. It's like, you know, it's this aura of – the collective, right? I mean, it's the collective.
Right.
But this 1228 number, or whatever, you know, that exact point, I mean, you know, right now we're seeing Bank of America come out with a 1350 12-month projection, only because we just blew past their year-end projection already, by the way. Earnings are ridiculous. Again, I don't want to, far be it for me for bringing the fundamental stuff, sorry. You know, but earnings are ridiculous, okay? Although the stocks are moving up well into the earnings, so it's kind of questionable if they've moved up too much. But nonetheless, some stocks are doing very well. And I think the biggest thing is that the idea that earnings are doing so well are shocking a lot of people, and people are just throwing in and saying, oh my gosh, look at these earnings, they're so great, I'm in, finally. But nonetheless, so at 1228, I mean, this is, we're talking about the market now, the S&P 500. You don't think that you think there's going to be a big fight there?
Oh, I do, and I think that these things are, they tend to be predictable, which is what I like about it. I think if they concede the rally to 1228, we get to 1228, let's say we even stop a few points shy, or we go 1231 and go a few points higher or something like that. I think that all the bears are going to say, you know what, well, not the bears, but people who are exasperated because the market's going up, they're just going to throw in a towel. They're going to say, okay, it's over. And I think at that point, then I don't want to sound like there's an invisible hand, but I think the powers that be and the people who believe in cycles and all that other sort of thing, they'll find a way to say that 1228 is the number and you should be short, and they'll start shorting the market. So I think that one way or another, the market's going to decline from 1228. If it's a 3% correction, 5%, 10%, who knows? But you'll get a decline from 1228. There will be a point when both bears and bulls will be on the exact same side and they'll both be selling, and it's probably 1228.
And that,
so there's
a
trade there.
And that's a market. That's the market itself. I mean, that excludes individual stock issues. I mean, you could have stocks that go up a lot, down a lot, you know, individually. But collectively, the S&P 500. What's the number on the Dow?
That's a good question. I don't spend any time looking at the Dow, but I will tell you, if I can look at it right now. Dow. Let me get the Fibonacci number.
By the way, do you mind telling us what tools you use so everybody can kind of figure out some great charting and all that? Is there anything particularly useful for it?
I am using Bloomberg, and I have TradeStation, which I use TradeStation most of the time.
How many screens do you have?
I have 5.
Oh boy, really?
That's my office.
It sounds exactly like my office. I have one Mac that we do our podcasting and things like that on in the back and all.
Right.
And then I have 4 screens, and we have Bloomberg and TradeStation actually. TradeStation, by the way, anything you need. Some of the TradeStation guys are good friends of mine that actually, honestly, a stone throws away from my office, the main headquarters for there. So if there's any particular calculations you need, the guy that does all the calculations is a good friend of mine. So
okay, good.
Now I'm going to get flooded with emails. Andrew, tell me about I'm not an expert in TradeStation. I know a good amount, but we use it more for kind of tracking and charting and all that. It's a very powerful mechanism, and the nice thing about TradeStation, as an example, I'll give you some example. Let me give you some working. I'm trying to fill some time while you get your Fibonacci's going here.
I got them.
But here's how you use it. Tell me how you use it. There's a couple of things we like to use. I mean, even though volume may not be important, volume breakout alerts are kind of interesting to look at. When they're, let's say, 20% over the average volume on a daily basis, you know, and you get a little bit of ticket, okay, what happened up or down? You know, what's going on? That oftentimes is a sign that there is some other players than the retail or the average, you know, people that are trading it on a daily basis. So we get volume breakouts. Second thing is you can get alerts, let's say, when something crosses up or down an average. Mm-hmm. And you got to be careful because that could be you can be getting dings all day. and there's a lot of things like that that are very interesting to chart and plot on the throughout TradeStation. I don't know if you use the radar screens like that, but we use them oftentimes to, you know, track the list of stocks we're looking at that we're interested in and to see if they break certain levels or if they're, you know, coming across. You could actually, you know, spend a little time pinpointing that in on the chart or the radar screen.
I do those, all of those same things.
Oh, cool.
Using the same things and using it the same way.
Oh, good. So what do you got for the Dow?
The Dow, I have a number of 11,245. So 11,245. That's a 61.8% retracement. And we're very close.
Right. And so the same theory holds on that one as well. I mean, obviously, but different.
I think you get to, there's certain things that people who are technical traders, and, you know, let's be honest, a lot of the hot money, a lot of the money that's managed by hedge funds, is technical. Mm-hmm. They have a technical aspect of it. I'm not saying there are not guys there that are out interviewing companies and doing all the fundamental stuff. There's certainly lots of those guys as well. But they have, in terms of actually deploying capital, they're doing it on a technical basis. They're looking for entry points and that sort of thing. And everybody has the same numbers. So everybody knows what the Fibonacci retracement is. And when I talk to hedge funds in my research business, they're all talking about the same numbers. They all know what they are. And I think if you get, you know, the most powerful trades are when you get both bulls and bears doing the same thing at the same time. So if they're all selling at 12.28, I think you're going to get a decline.
Now, here's the problem. Let me throw this at you, okay? And here's where the problem comes in. So all the first part of our discussion, we talked about, you know, moving averages. We talked about the trends. We talked about, you know, not fighting the tape. At 12.28, that means from here it's going to be a higher tape or a higher price than the current tape, right? Under normal circumstances, if you didn't know anything about Mr. or Dr. or Professor Fibonacci, you would say, okay, the trend is going higher. You wouldn't have any argument with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're well above your 50, 20s, and all that. Question then is entry of the trade. So here's the point. So you would say, okay, about around 12.28 or so, I'm going to put a trade on that's going to be short the S&P 500, whether it's an option, whether it's an ETF, whether it's a just whatever future, whatever you're using, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you're going to say, okay, if it goes and it really blows out above this, I may move out of the trade and then roll back down. If it starts, you know, I may go in and out of a few times also. But nonetheless, 12.28 or so, you're going to be in that trade. But that goes against a little bit of the trend in fighting the tape, doesn't it?
Well, see, I'm not saying I'm going to. I would not short the market at 12. Well, that's not true. Let me back up. I will short the market at 12.28, but I'll short it against my existing long portfolio.
Right.
So I'm long.
So you're going to hedge.
Yeah, I'm going to hedge. Because I think that the odds of having a fantastic rally through 1228 are small, and the odds of a pullback, it could be 3%, 5%, could be 10%, but I'm going to start hedging my portfolio at 1228. I won't short them. I will short the market. My individual stocks, I'm going to keep them.
Okay, so now that makes sense, and that's exactly what we do, by the way. We have a lot in common, you and I. But here's the question. You're not going to be fully hedged because the stocks can take a lot more volatility than the market, of course, but you're at least going to get a little bit of downside protection. That's what you're going to do. And obviously, if it keeps rolling down, you may unwind your stocks if they start all of a sudden changing their trend, of course. And then that ends up being eventually, the theory is it could be a fully short position, you know, as things go on. But again, here's the question I have. When you look at that, where is it that you pull your hedge off? So 1228 you put on an S&P hedge. There is no particular, what do? You wait for it to bounce on the 20 day again, let's say, or the 50?
Yep. Yeah, I would put on my hedge at 1228 if we get there. I'd probably be looking to exit some into 1150, and the same numbers, 1115, and same thing. Mm-hmm. Just taking off bits and pieces, but just as a hedge. I still have my existing long book on.
Right.
I'm still long stocks.
Right.
But and some of those will go through their moving averages and they'll be stopped out.
Right, exactly.
But you want to stay long stocks as long as the trend is higher.
And then and then you'll pull your hedge at, let's say, I'm just picking a number, 1250. I'm just using that number as a
number. Yeah.
You know, you pull it at 1250 where that is clearly above not only a reflection bounce, if you will, or a move. It's clearly signaling that this Fibonacci is broken and move on again until it's proven otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
But during the interim, of course, I'm still long. I'm still long my book of stocks, and I take a small loss on what is insurance by buying that or shorting the market at 1228.
Right, hoping that the delta or the of the individual stocks is much more powerful than the entire market itself.
Correct.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
And the same thing is short. Now, will you go short the individual stocks when the market rolls down, or are you pretty much just going to be, you know, market related?
I was taught by an old guy from the insurance industry and to do technical analysis. He told me that the way to short the market is to short stocks that look like you could ski. So you want to short stocks that are in downtrends.
Mm.
There are not a lot of stocks in downtrends right now. So it's going to be tough to get aggressively short stocks. I'll probably be short stocks through the index. So I might have, in theory, what would happen is my stocks would be stopped out, and then I would add a new
index
position short.
Yeah, because the problem is that these days, what it seems like when a stock is ready to break down and you're ready to put a short on, somebody comes out with some whopper of an upgrade.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, what happened there? I mean, you know, look at the education stocks. They looked like they were kind of down and out there for a little while, and they were starting to roll down, and it was, you know, and it's like, you know, wham. The educational whole sector is upgraded, and they just go straight up because they sucked in a lot of the shorts. They sucked in a lot of the shorts, and then they just whacked them over the head.
Yeah.
So,
this is definitely a tough market to be a bear. It's tough to be a bear in a bull market.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to call it the bull market, a bull cycle. I think it's a cycle. I would call it a bull market until we take out the October 2007 highs.
Oh, really? So we got to go back to the 1500 something or other.
Oh, yeah. You've got to get, you can't be in a downtrend and call it a bull market. It's not a bull market.
I'll go there.
Until we make higher highs, you have a down market, right?
Yep, that's a good point. Good point.
Cycle.
Any other last comments that you can help us out in terms of an investor out there? I mean, I had a guy just today, I was talking on the phone with him. He says, so I listen to so-and-so, and, you know, they're looking at Elliott Ways and this and that, and he says to me, do you think we're going to hit the lows again? You know, the lows. I said, you know, I got to tell you the truth. Anything's possible. You know, I'm not going to say yes or no. I don't know. You know, how do I know what's going to happen next? I mean, Greece and Portugal, who knows what's going to happen there? You know, we enter into a world war. I don't know. Right now, the way it stands right now, it looks like not for a while, because no matter what happens, the governments are going to come in. Listen, I guarantee you, and tell me what you think about this. If we start on a 5% decline in the markets, we're going to start hearing about all sorts of short selling rules.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's definitely fixed. I mean, they definitely want the market to go up. I'll tell you this. I was watching, and I rarely do this, but one day I was watching Tim Geithner, and he had this sort of town hall thing, and I just find it fascinating. So I'm watching him, and they're talking about all these stimulus programs they've had, and the net effect, and all these treasury programs that he's been more responsible for. And he says, well, you know, if you look at the capital markets, look at the bond market, look at the stock market, look how well they performed, then they must be working. Well, that's not necessarily true. The fact that the capital markets are going up doesn't mean his programs are working. But it's more valuable still if it gives you an insight into the thinking.
Right.
The thinking is they're looking at the markets, and if the markets are going up, their stuff is working.
Right.
So
right.
It's easy for them to influence the markets. I mean, Rubin, during the Clinton years, was a master. He'd come out and just say the right thing. He knew what to say. You know, he had years of experience doing that sort of thing. He'd come out and say the right thing, the market went up.
Right.
So if you were a bear and Paul Rubin, or if you were a bear and Robert Rubin was coming out, and you know you were in trouble.
That's kind of like what happened with Bernanke. Bernanke does the same thing.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, but my point is, I guess, is that they're measuring their success by the level of stock prices.
The other
and
thing,
if that's the case,
yeah.
Then,
the problem is the other thing is, I mean, I don't know. I read this and I can probably find this news bit. Ben Bernanke has a portfolio that includes equities. Now, I don't know.
That's, is that true?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
How if that is true, how screwed up is that? Right?
Well, he would say he just wants to participate in the capital markets like everybody else.
I understand that, but you know what? That's what we call blind pools for, right?
Yeah, I know.
And that,
I know.
You know, and there was a report that showed he had a variable annuity with X amount of dollars in it, and it was in the equity. There was equity portion and plus in other assets, et cetera. But even if he only had that variable annuity with the equity exposure, you know, it seems to me that, you know, he's human. He wants the markets to go up. Everybody wants the markets to go up, by the way. I mean, or mm-hmm. Everybody wants to make money. Forget about whether the markets go up or not. But the general consensus, you know, most people are long only. They want the markets to go up. That's what, you know, most people want. And nobody can say anything other than that. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, I agree with you that this administration and even the last, you know, they were all about, you know, making the markets go up, because if they make the markets go up, in a way, it's stimulus. Think about it. You know, it's more money people have to spend, and that's a good thing. So
it's not just having more money to spend. People feel good when the market's going up.
Right.
They think that the market is some all-knowing entity, and the market must know something good is happening. Why else would it be going up?
Right.
And it makes people feel good.
Right.
So it's easy to get the market to go up too, by the way. They just have to say the right things.
Right. Yeah, no. But, just elongated, you know, no interest rate increases forever.
That's right. Oh, there you go. How about that? Free money forever.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. Good stuff. All right. So great. Yeah. I appreciate you. Listen, I'm going to tell everybody that, of course, Terry is available. You know, you can find out more about him. Simply go over to... it looks like Bear Search, but I think it's BA Research.
BA Research, yeah. That was something we didn't think about at the time we were selecting the name.
Right, BearSearch.com, BARE.
Yeah.
You're doing some work with The Street? What's going on there?
Pardon me?
Are you doing something with TheStreet.com lately?
We're going to be contributing to their new options section, which is going to come out in about, I think, 3 weeks.
Good, very nice. Excellent. So Terry's available for some good information. He has a variety of different publications. And go over to BA Research. We'll make sure to put the address on the, or Bear Search, whatever you want to call it. we'll put that information on the show notes from this episode. And Terry Bedford, just an amazing insight, very simplistic. And I appreciate your coming aboard the Discipline Investor podcast and sharing it with us.
All right. Hopefully you'll have me back.
I will. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, that was great. Wasn't that great? Terry's awesome. He's so it's so simple. It's so easy to understand. It's eloquent. The way of doing things is eloquent. His technical analysis and, this is a smart guy. And I think one of the things I've always really admired is someone who could put information that may be very hard to digest and hard to understand in very simplistic terms. That's a sign of a really good teacher and someone who really has a good grasp of what's going on. So thanks so much for Terry for helping us with all of that. And we have Frank Curzio coming up just around the corner. We have, I think next week actually, Frank's coming on. Frank and I have been talking. He moved down to Florida, if you don't know that. And Frank and I talk regularly, as a matter of fact, about 50 times a day. and we have each other on IM. So we're always going back and forth on all sorts of different ideas and things, and really a, kind of a part of the overall brain work, if you will, and it helps me clear my head, and hopefully we do the same. But anyway, I know you love Frank, so he's coming on. We have a trader coming on that will teach you a few things about overall trading coming on in a few weeks. We have actually the head of trading and research from Briefing Again coming on in a few weeks. Boy, lots coming up. Please stay tuned. Do me a favor, leave a quick review on iTunes if you would, and a review and a rating. I'd appreciate that. And of course, just to follow up and to finish up, if you want some more information on how to invest with us, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and go to the show notes of this particular podcast. There's a little link there. Do yourself a favor, check it out. I think you'll really enjoy what you see and find out more about what we do. Until next week, have a profitable week. Be careful, be disciplined. I'll see you right around the corner. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.